Accession number 21095, Reel 5.
In this terrible fate.
Hello, Pick, Reel 5.
Had Chad in this terrible fate, and now, of course, and had all become victims, and now they could rebuild the nation, which had been pretty shattered already in the 30s and divided very bitterly, very deeply between elements who really wanted the greater Germany and those who thought that somehow, sort of post-Habsburg Empire, there could be an Austria. Well, now was their new opportunity to rebuild, to build up that country, and seeing themselves as victims certainly helped a lot. I've discussed this victim syndrome with people who lived through the war, including two or three very prominent people, and they were all horrified that I questioned the victimhood and tried to argue strenuously that anyone who really understood Austria would have to see that, you know, a good half of the country certainly were nothing but victims, and, you know, they would be very self-righteous and say, well, you know, our father was even in the concentration camp. And I would say, yes, but he survived, and they also had rather different treatment. Yes, but they were in concentration camps and so on, and they were clearly Hitler's victims and so on. So that to this very day, there are older people in Vienna who remain convinced that anyone who denies that Austria had been a victim, no doubt as well as a perpetrator, but certainly victim too, just simply doesn't understand Austria. What I found very shocking, and again, I didn't know that until I started researching this book on Austria, that on the eve of the signing of the Austrian State Treaty, the Austrian Chancellor went to the foreign ministers of the four occupying powers who were the guarantors of the treaty, and said to them that they wanted to scrap from the preamble to the state treaty the phrase which had been in the original Moscow Declaration, that, I mean, still leaving inside the victimhood, but the Moscow Declaration had also had a clause which said that Austria must bear its share of responsibility for the Nazi era. And I'm paraphrasing, but that was the gist of it. And the Austrian Chancellor, on the eve of the state treaty signing, said he wanted that phrase taken out of the preamble to the state treaty. And much to their surprise, the three Western foreign ministers had not expected it. Mr. Molotov, the Soviet foreign minister, agreed. Because the original clause had been a Soviet had been done at Soviet insistence, and the only reason, the only way in which you can explain this is that at that time Khrushchev was more intent on demonstrating to the world that the Soviet Union wanted peaceful coexistence, that the state treaty was the vehicle to demonstrate this, that they no longer needed Austria as a place where they had to keep Soviet troops, because one of the reasons why Austria had been so important to the Russians in their expansionist period, to have troops stationed in Austria, was because they could then justify taking the troops through Poland and Hungary and Czechoslovakia as transit countries to their deployments in Austria. By now they had the Warsaw Pact. The Warsaw Pact gave them the right to station forces in Eastern Europe, so they no longer needed the fig leaf of the Austrian occupation to get into, to have military, their military in the satellite countries. So in other words, there was nothing much to be lost by giving up Austria, so to speak, and it was better in terms of Soviet strategies to have a neutral country in the middle of Europe than to continue to have it occupied by the four powers, and have the four powers and the rest of Austria with their forces, now NATO forces. So anyway, for one reason or another, Molotov agreed, and so the Austrians went into their full independence in 1955 with a sort of completely clean bill of health as a victim country, but no longer with any responsibilities. Now, when I just, I mean, that, I found that really in the end quite extraordinary that they allowed that to happen, because after all, the four together could have insisted on retaining that clause, because psychologically, of course, it reinforced everything that the Austrians wanted to know. And the other thing, of course, that I found so shocking now when I was researching this book is that a British historian discovered in the archives, buried in the archives, the minutes of early cabinet meetings from the immediate post-war years. And the discussions there demonstrated the deep anti-Semitism that was being expressed by ministers who, by no stretch of the imagination, had been Nazis, who had in fact been in concentration camps, and who, as far as their sort of politics were concerned and their relationship to the Nazis, they had a clean bill of health. And yet this anti-Semitism came through over and over again. And at the same time, even these people who had been in the camps were more concerned what arrangements could be made to bring Austrian prisoners of war back from Russia, how to compensate them, and again, how to legalize the position of the ex-Nazis who, in the first post-war election in 45 in Austria, had not been allowed to vote. By the next election in 49, they had had their vote restored. And in fact, and again, I only found that out when I was researching the Simon Wiesenthal biography, but again with this book, the extent to which the two mainstream parties had helped to sponsor and encourage the formation of a new grouping around the former Nazi Party members, because there were 500,000 of them, and the Austrians and the two main parties each wanted their vote, because that would help, you know, it was going to help them, obviously. And the socialists were particularly keen, because the socialists were constantly emerging as a minority, a large minority, but they were unable to gain the chancellorship. Austrians had coalition governments almost continuously, with the exception of the Kreisky period. And in order to do that, they needed the help of the Nazis, who at first formed something called the Union of Independence, which later, after 1955, became the Freedom Party, which is today Jörg Haider's party. And at first, I mean, both parties flirted with this grouping, but the socialists did better with them, offered them more, were more tolerant of them, and in the early post-war elections helped them with sort of marginal things like giving them posters and placards and things like that. But in the 1960s, they were helping them financially, quite substantially. And when Kreisky became chancellor in the first time, when he was in a minority government, and he thought he could only survive with the support of the Freedom Party, he promised them to change the electoral law so they would be able to gain more seats if, in exchange, they supported him, his lead in Parliament, and particularly helped to pass the budget. In the end, they balked at the budget, but he did change the electoral laws. So, you know, all of this I discovered afterwards, but all of this reinforced my view, you know, that Austria's love of victimhood was totally unjustified, and I can understand that it helped to create a sense of national unity and a sense of identity, but at the same time, to allow a whole nation to live a lie for so many years is very, very... I think in terms of Austrian history, it is wholly, it will not be seen to have been a very wise thing to have done. And
Were the Jewish organisations not active in this respect, though, because they well knew what had happened, didn't they? Were they not having any sort of impact on this?
Well, there was a small Jewish community. Don't forget that most of Austria's Jews had either gone and
yes,
were either dead.
Yes, well, you know, the world situation and people who were...
Look, the World Jewish Congress was only interested in compensation and restitution, and I have very strong feelings about the World Jewish Congress, but that really relates to Byzantine more than anything else. But there was a small Jewish community in Vienna. I mean, one of the things that the Vienna Austrians refused to do was to encourage Jewish emigres to return to Vienna after the war, because they didn't want to give them back their housing. You know, they were arguing so much had been destroyed in Vienna, they needed the housing for themselves. They couldn't cope with emigres coming back and claiming their properties. A few came back, and those who claimed in the first two or three post-war years got property back. But then when the Cold War started in earnest and the West was no longer interested in denazification in Austria at all and just left the Austrian authorities to their own devices, then they just put a stop to it all. And they certainly did nothing to encourage people to come back. So, and the Jewish community that was in Austria, all centered on Vienna, was deeply divided politically and on classic political lines. I mean, some were socialist and some were conservative. And I mean, I learned this from Simon Wiesenthal, because he came into the middle of this. And being an individualist and rather quarrelsome, he soon ended up quarreling with all of them. But I mean, the way he tells it, the socialist group in the Jewish community in Vienna was much more interested in helping the socialists acquire properties or anyway and gaining their favors, and were not really interested in looking after anybody except themselves. And I suspect that the conservative element was very similar, but whatever it is, they were not looking, I mean, they were just looking after themselves in slightly bizarre ways. So that there was not going to be much pressure there for Austria to change. And it has to be said that in their contacts with the Jewish community, the Austrian politicians were always intent on telling them how much they cared for them, how much they understood their problems, how much they wanted to help. It's just they didn't do anything. But they went through the motions of saying we can sympathize with your problems. But that was not a priority. And in a way, the only priority was to delay things as much as possible. And none of this really came to a head until Waldheim. In the interim, there had been quite a lot of pressure from the American government for restitution, partly because oil companies which had had property in Austria also wanted compensation. And successive Austrian chancellors were pressed to do things, but they always said that they were being asked to do too much and this, that, and the other. Virtually nothing was done. And it was only when the whole world focused on Austria over Waldheim that the leadership finally realized that you couldn't go on doing what Kreisky had done, which was to say, let's just draw a line over the past and start it up again. That they had to recognize that they had some responsibility for what had happened.
How traumatic was that for Austria, you know, when Waldheim's background was known and others sort of implicated?
Well, what was traumatic for Austria was that the whole world suddenly turned against Austria and told them that they had a war criminal who wanted to be their president. I think, you know, this is a very murky story, because the World Jewish Congress has always claimed that the original story came from Vienna, from the Socialist Party, who at that point were still trying to gain support for their candidate for the presidency, for their own socialist candidate, and somehow mysteriously thought that if they could feed out a story about Waldheim, which would then come reverberating back to Austria, that that was a way of undermining Waldheim. I've known Waldheim since the 1960s, when he was ambassador in Austrian ambassador to the United Nations. And I've interviewed him afterwards as president. I knew him as UN Secretary General. I have always agreed, long before I interviewed Wiesenthal on the subject, and he feels exactly the same, that Waldheim lied, but that I have never believed that Waldheim was a war criminal in the way in which he was perceived by so many elements in the outside world, particularly in the United States. I think Waldheim is an incredibly weak character. I don't think he would ever stick his head above the parapet for anything. And when all is said and done, he was in Yugoslavia during the war as a lieutenant. He certainly had no inherent powers for decision-making. I think he knew what was going on because he was in an intelligence unit, and there's no doubt that he knew. But I don't think he would ever have had any real hand in any of the events that took place there. And he lied because he's wily and because he's ambitious and because he's always lied. I know that when I have interviewed him for these books that he has lied to me, and I can come back to that, about certain events in 68 and so on. He just lies, but basically all he wants, he always wanted to promote himself, he always wanted to have these senior positions. I think that the Security Council gave him a second term of office because they knew that he was pliable, that he was malleable, that he could be influenced by them, that he wouldn't cause any trouble, and that it was less trouble to re-elect him than to spend days and weeks, possibly months, arguing about a replacement for him as UN Secretary General, which would certainly at the time have been an extremely controversial issue. He was just the easy way out. But to get back to the Austrian reaction, I was in Austria at the time reporting for The Guardian, the Austrians just felt they could not accept that an outside power or outside powers dictate to them how they should vote in a presidential election. That when all is said and done, they were a democracy. They had the right to vote whoever they wanted to vote for. And they did not want to be dictated to by the outside world. I think there are a lot of people who still question whether Waldheim would have been elected if this campaign against him had not been fought from the outside. I too doubt it. I think it's perfectly possible that he only won with a very narrow majority on the second round of voting, and I wouldn't have been at all surprised if he'd lost. But given the circumstances at the time, I think the Austrians just sort of rose up against this and said, we will not be dictated to. And yet, at the same time, Chancellor Vranitzky, who was the Austrian Chancellor at the time, did understand that there was a message in all that had happened, and the message was that finally Austria had to come to terms with its history and recognize it. But even then, again, I was just surprised when I learned, which again I only did when I was writing this book on Austria, the details of how it came about, that between Waldheim's election in 86 and 91, nothing had actually happened, that it took Branitsky until 91 before he made the official declaration before Parliament that Austria indeed had a moral responsibility for the events during the Nazi period. And it became all the more curious when I talked about this with a friend of mine. His name is Hugo Portisch. He is Austria's most distinguished television commentator, and he's made some remarkable documentary films about Austria's post-war history. I mean, remarkable oral and visual histories and very outspoken ones of Austria. But anyway, he told me, and he then showed me the correspondence that he had with Ranitzky, that in 1985, when Ranitzky became chancellor, he invited a small group of people to advise him on how he should handle this whole issue of Austria's history and the victimhood and the big lie and all the rest of it. And my friend Hugo Portisch wrote him a memorandum in which he advised him that he should make this declaration in his first government statement to Parliament almost straight away, certainly in 1986, and that this should include also all kinds of practical measures on restitution and this restoring the nationality and a whole shoal of things. And Ranitzky acknowledged all of this, and then nothing happened until 91, and then he finally decided to make this speech. And again, Hugo Portisch was asked to help draft the speech. And the speech, in fact, included many of the elements that had been in the original memorandum in 1985. And I wrote this in one of the chapters, and I showed a draft of this to an Austrian historian who's become a very good friend, because I showed him most of what I was writing. And when he saw that chapter, he apparently took it to Ranitzky, because he was doing an oral history with Ranitzky. And Ranitzky bridled and said, "This is not true, and this didn't happen, and there was no correspondence, and Hellerpick has got it all wrong, and none of this happened." And my friend, the historian, came back to me and told me that, and I said, "Look, here's the correspondence. I have the copies of it, and bona fides." And he said, "Yes, you're right, and Ranitzky has got it all wrong." So then I went to see Ranitzky, and he again said, "You know, this isn't true, that he'd been advised to do this." And then I said, "Well, why did you take so long before you decided to go ahead when you apparently had made up your mind, soon after you became chancellor, that Austria had to recognize that what had happened during the war?" And he said, "Because public opinion wasn't ready for it, and in 91 I finally decided now public opinion was ready." And
is there something in that, do you think?
Well, I think this is a question of leadership. I think it would have been perfectly... what does it mean public opinion was ready for it? I mean, he had to give the lead. There was absolutely no reason why he shouldn't have stood up soon after Waldheim had been made president and said, because he was dead against Waldheim being president. And I remember an interview with him, must have been about, 89, 90, when he made quite plain that he was on the verge of resigning if Waldheim didn't resign. But, Waldheim didn't resign. And then in the end, he didn't, Ranitzky also didn't go. But, he made plain in every interview that he gave that he distanced himself from Waldheim and wanted to have nothing to do with him. But... I think he just lacked the courage, and I know him much better now. And he's a very, in many ways, a perfectly decent person, but courageous he's not. And what really upset me very much is that finally, when my book was published, and we invited him to the publishing party, and he didn't come, and then I phoned up and I said, "Sorry." I talked to his secretary and said, "I'm sorry that Dr. Ranitzky didn't come." And she said, "He couldn't." And I said, "Well, I'd like to come and see him and give him a copy of the book." And she said, well, I think that'll be very difficult. And I said, what's the matter? So she said, oh, you know, he's very busy. So I said, come on, something is wrong. And she said, all right, I'll put you through to him. And he said, no, I see absolutely no reason for seeing you. And as you may have guessed, I'm very upset with parts of your book. And he apparently bitterly resents that I have printed the fact that, you know, he had a memorandum on what he should do. And he also, I think in one of the conversations, said that it's absolute nonsense to suggest that my friend Hugo Portish had anything to do with writing the declaration that he did make to Parliament. And I mentioned that to Eva Novotny, who for some time was Austrian ambassador here, but at the time was foreign policy advisor to Vranitsky. And she said, I don't know what he's talking about. Hugo Portish and I were sitting together writing that speech. You know, so, I mean, it's just deception once again. But, I mean, you know, I think the fact that is important to me is that he had the opportunity, he understood, and, you know, he's an honorable man in terms of he didn't cling to the lie as far as he was personally concerned, that he knew that it had to be done, that the country had to be brought to reality, and yet it took him 4 years, 4.5 years, before he finally had the courage, the political courage to do it. Once he'd done it, he kept it up all the time. And to be fair, you know, in between all that period, he was making odd speeches here and there. But what mattered is that he made that declaration in Parliament, and that it somehow had the sort of the force of the Austrian democracy behind it. And that he had not had the courage to do before.
The campaign against Waldheim was quite strident, wasn't it? Very strong.
It was very strident, but it came mainly from the outside.
Was that at all counterproductive for sort of Austrian politics, do you think?
Well, I think it was in terms of certainly having Waldheim elected, and it certainly helped the Freedom Party. Haider became head of the Freedom Party in 86, and that's quite significant, that because previously, and the Freedom Party, its first leader had been someone called Friedrich Peter, who was exposed by Wiesenthal as a member of the SS, and Wiesenthal claimed that he'd had a direct hand in one particularly horrific killing in Poland. And that was the cause of his big quarrel with Kreisky, but I think perhaps we'll come to that when we talk about Wiesenthal. But I have talked to Friedrich Peter, who was the original leader. He's one of the very few people where I would say that I've been wholly convinced that this is a man who has radically changed his ideas and his outlook and his beliefs. He freely accepts that he was a volunteer in the SS. He denies that he was involved in this killing, because he claims that he was at the time in an army hospital. And he has letters which he wrote to his wife, which suggest that at the time, which really appear to confirm, if those letters are genuine, that he was in a hospital. But I've had long talks with him about his dealings with Kreisky and how the party got money and so on. Anyway, he was forced to resign after Wiesenthal exposed him for his having been a member of the SS. His successors were sort of very ordinary, anodyne people who by no stretch of the imagination could be tainted with a sort of extreme right-wing label or Nazi association. And it was there. It was under that new label that the successor to Kreisky went into a coalition government with the Freedom Party. But Haider became leader in 86,